Your data, like it or not, it's out there today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Facebook's facing scrutiny after 50 million users had their data scraped for political purposes. But here's the thing, if you're online, you're a target.
Even trivial or seemingly innocuous data about us can be used and aggregated to make decisions about not only what advertising we receive, but what content we receive as well.
Also, point guard KJ Maura helped UMBC make March Madness history, and his former youth coach in Puerto Rico is over the moon about it.
Oh, it was an honor to me just to see him there. I saw him playing since he was 8 years old, and there's no words to describe that.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Glad you could make it. Facebook's latest controversy, that's where we start our show this Monday. And like so many controversies on social media in the past year, this one involves the 2016 U.S. presidential election. According to reports by the New York Times and the London Observer over the weekend, this one all began with a seemingly innocuous app that runs in Facebook. It's a personality predictor developed by a psychology professor in the U.K. If you downloaded the app and took the various fun quizzes, you also agreed to hand over some personal information. But you did not agree with what came next. That data was then shared with Cambridge Analytica, a data analytics team that worked with both Donald Trump's election team in the run-up to the U.S. presidential vote and the Leave campaign during the U.K.'s Brexit vote. The firm reportedly gained access to the information of about 50 million Facebook users.
If one person, if you joined the app, I would not just see your Facebook profile, I would see all of the Facebook profiles of everybody that you're friends with.
That's former Cambridge Analytica employee, now whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, speaking to The Guardian. He says ultimately the goal was to use the data to change audience behavior, to sway votes.
So we would know what kinds of messaging you would be susceptible to, including the framing of it, the topics, the content, and then how many times do we need to touch you with that in order to change how you think about something.
Lots of stuff to dissect here, but today we want to zero in on just one thing, the data. So we reached out to Nuala O'Connor. She's with the Center for Democracy and Technology, which has offices in the U.S. and in Europe. She spoke with us from Washington.
All of us have used those apps, those kind of frivolous or trivial apps on Facebook and other platforms where you ask for things like your first name and your, you know, favorite color and get to read out on what kind of astrological sign you should most marry or things like that. Really silly or trivial or kind of entertaining things. But what we're, I think, all waking up to this morning is the realization that even trivial or seemingly innocuous data about us can be used and aggregated and analyzed to make decisions about what we see online, not only what advertising we receive, but what content we receive as well.
What do we know for sure, Nuala, about how that data was used during the 2016 U.S. presidential election and also during the Brexit vote?
There is still a lot of gray area or fuzziness about exactly what data went there. And that's really, I think, the source of consternation this week. Certainly people are legitimately online on social media platforms and using the apps that they want. But what I don't think people expect is that that data is going to feed into what are called psychometric profiles that have been shared with companies like Cambridge Analytica and their various partners.
And I suspect that's your concern as well.
Well, our group is called the Center for Democracy and Technology. So we believe that technology can be an enabler of great democratic institutions and values around the world. We hope that the internet opens your worldview and exposes you to new ideas. What's worrisome about this is that as people engage in more and more micro-targeting or really specific targeting, which of course has always happened in the marketing and advertising and even in the political space, but as it gets more and more narrowly scoped, the impact on our democratic institutions is concerning, to say the least.
So based on what you know about data privacy laws here in the U.S. and in Europe, did Facebook or any of the other entities involved in this case violate the law?
Well, it's important to note, and I know that, that Facebook in particular has made it very clear, they do not conceive of this as a breach, and that's probably correct under U.S. law. But what we're thinking about it today really is this a breach of trust on the part of the various companies involved and their users? Do I expect when I go online and I figure out, as I did on Saturday, what my leprechaun name was based on my first name and my month of birth, do I really expect that that data is going to be used to decide or to guess what political party I am or to serve me particular ads that increasingly, again, narrow my worldview? Do people have a real understanding? Do they have transparency about what these companies are collecting and using about them? Do they have control? Can they move their data around and change companies or delete data at the time when they no longer want to have it out there? And do they have agency?
Just before we go on, what is your advice for people, at least here in the U.S., don't ever use these third-party apps?
I will say I have certainly decreased my use of the entertainment apps, but every once in a while something is interesting enough that even I do it. So I'm like, that. What is the cobbler's children who have no shoes? So I would say it's unreasonable to ask people not to use a major social media platform that is essential and again, a real positive force in many ways. But when you get into the more, again, sensitive uses like political dialogue and political speech, the query is, how should these activities be regulated or constrained? We've got a good dialogue going, even though the U.S. is still behind Europe in enacting federal comprehensive privacy laws. But it's not just enough to know exactly the data elements. The real question is, who got to see it, who got to use it, and what effect did it have on my understanding of the world?
So according to reporting from over the weekend, Facebook had known for years, since 2015 apparently, that Cambridge Analytica had gained access to this data. Why did it take so long for them to speak out, to do something about this? And do you see a pattern at Facebook of this? And is that problem perhaps changing?
I think that my understanding is they were aware of a misuse or of certain data flowing, that they shut it down in 2015 and were given assurances by the various parties that the data had been deleted. What I think we're learning now, and I do not know exactly the timeline of when the company learned that the data wasn't deleted, that it was shared in ways that were unexpected or that really were outside of contractual boundaries. I've always said that companies in the ecosystem, and again, I used to work in internet companies and data kind of privacy and stewardship issues in the private sector. I think contracts have always been a good tool to use, but clearly what it's showing is that they're not an adequate tool to use to protect our data. We need to think about better technological barriers, better ways of deleting data, both individually as in large data sets, and maybe also de-identifying data so that it's not linked. If you're trying to do pattern analysis, again, to place an ad advertisement or an ad buy, perhaps we don't need to have everyone's name and address or even sensitive data in making those determinations. But what clearly strikes me is a lack of control on the part of the end user on how their data is collected, stored, and shared with other parties.
Nuala O'Connor with the Center for Democracy and Technology speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As you probably know, the Russians had an election yesterday, and you probably also heard the unsurprising news that Vladimir Putin won. We caught up with reporter Charles Maines today in Moscow.
I don't know what the right metaphor here is, but it was a slaughter. Vladimir Putin completely overwhelmed his opponents. He received 76% of the vote. His closest challenger was the Communist Party candidate, Pavel Grudinin, who received 14% of the vote. The liberal candidates registered in single digits. But fundamentally, Marco, you know, this election was never really about Putin's victory. Turnout here was the key factor, in part because Alexei Navalny, this is the opposition leader and arguably the only real threat to Putin, he was barred from the election on a legal technicality and it called for nationwide boycott. So Kremlin spin doctors, they came in saying that they wanted a 70-75% turnout. They got 67%, certainly enough to give the impression of a mandate that Putin very much wanted.
And yet Putin and the Kremlin present this election as an exercise in democracy. I mean, election observers live for elections like this. What are they reporting in terms of violations, if any?
Well, right. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, came in and they said that there had been no real choice in this presidential election and complained that it was marked by unfair pressure on critical voices. That's, I think, very much true. We also heard from Golos. This is a Russian independent vote monitoring group, and they reported mass violations throughout the country. They also called this election neither free nor fair. We had videos of ballot stuffing, carousel voting. This is when they bus people in to vote at stations. And then also just kind of games and gimmicks. You know, there were raffles for cars, iPhones, free medical exams, even just free food, which was very reminiscent of, you know, how the Soviet authorities would get people out to vote in elections during the Soviet Union.
So I know it's hard to generalize, but what kind of reaction are you hearing from voters? Is this a good day, a bad day?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, I spent the day at polling stations just talking to average people to get a sense of, you know, what was going on. You know, I just want to give you the taste of it. This is a woman, a pensioner named Tamara Kruglova. I asked her about the election, and what I liked so much about her response mainly was that she seemed as though it was the dumbest question I could have ever have possibly asked her. Who did she vote for?
Ну, за кого? Конечно, за Путина, естественно. Потому что он единственный, кто не хочет войны. Он очень мирный парень и хороший.
So this is Tamara saying, you know, who did I vote for? Of course I voted for Putin, naturally, because he's the only one who doesn't want war. She says Putin is this peaceful, all-around good guy, and that for the next 6 years it means that Russians will have stability and that the people trust him.
What about young people in this election, Charles? Was there lower turnout because Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, was barred from running?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. What is clear is that people that voted for Putin, they skewed older. That's not to say he didn't get part of the young vote, but it reflected an enthusiasm gap, I think, in the way that Navalny has caught on with younger voters. You know, as you noted, Navalny was not in the race. He called for this boycott. But instead, we had Ksenia Sobchak, whose presence in the race was very controversial in a lot of ways. She is a socialite turned journalist. Her father was Putin's mentor in St. Petersburg once upon a time. And people have really looked at her as trying to divide the opposition and that she was running with Kremlin permission. It certainly divided a lot of younger Russians and liberal Russians, and among those was Dmitry Alexeyev. This is a 22-year-old first-time voter who supported Sobchak in the race.
Я считаю, что все-таки выборы довольно важное событие, хотя я и знаю, что, скорее всего, ничего не изменится из-за них. То есть я.
So Dmitry's saying, look, I think elections are important, even if I know they won't change anything. And he likes Navalny, he sympathizes with Navalny, but he thinks a boycott is a bad strategy, one that serves Navalny's interests and not the general Russian voter.
I read that Putin got more votes yesterday than he did back in the last election in 2012. So should that tell us that he's even in a stronger position now?
Well, yes. I mean, I think fundamentally it's he got the mandate he wanted, barring the unforeseen. You know, he'll rule Russia until 2024. But there are already concerns over who takes over next, you know, when and if Putin disappears from the scene. And over the short term, you know, he's promised a lot in this race. He's promised things to the defense sector. He's promised to invest in social programs, to raise income for Russians, all while sparring with the West over sanctions, over Crimea. And then we have this poisoning of the former Russian spy in London that's not likely to help.
Yeah, 6 more years of Putin. What is the mood the day after elections in Russia, especially after somebody like Putin gets re-elected?
You know, it's been just a normal day in Moscow, really. I think this was such an expected result. There's none of this kind of hand-wringing. Even Navalny issued a plea to his supporters today saying, look, we knew this was going to happen. The work is all ahead for us. Nothing about this was remarkable in any way.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up on the show, why the BBC World Service began broadcasting in foreign languages some 80 years ago. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. If you're a regular listener, you know that our colleagues at the BBC World Service have a wealth of stories, and not just in English. The World Service broadcasts to audiences around the globe in dozens of different languages. But how did that all start and why? Well, from a marketing point of view, it makes a lot of sense, of course, but it was World War II that actually had a lot to do with it. The Axis powers were spreading their messages on the airwaves in multiple languages, and that prompted the British to follow suit. My colleague Mike Lanchon takes us back to March 1938, 80 years ago, when the BBC first launched its broadcasts for Latin America.
From London and the BBC, greetings to all listeners in Central and South America.
It was in the small hours of March the 15th, 1938, March the 14th in Latin America, that the BBC's first Director General, Lord John Reith, welcomed what he hoped would be a huge new audience across the other side of the world.
We are going to speak to you every evening in future in your own languages.
Desde hoy en adelante, Hablaremos a ustedes en sus propios idiomas.
The news bulletins will follow the 15-year-old tradition.
Estes noticiários manter-se-ão dentro da nossa maneira.
In 1938, the outbreak of World War II was still more than a year away. Adolf Hitler was using radio to spread the Nazis' message of hate overseas, with shortwave broadcasts in English to North America and elsewhere. But it was the German and Italian broadcasts in Arabic to the Arab world and in Spanish and Portuguese to Latin America that were causing most concern in London. This is from a 1937 report marked strictly confidential, compiled by Felix Green, the BBC's representative at the time in North America.
We are facing damaging propaganda in all its forms. It's a history of bitter and far from honourable competition and the gradual elimination of Britain as a source of international news.
Estación de Londres de la BBC.
The British government's response was to authorise the BBC to launch its own Arabic and Latin American language services to combat the influence of the Axis powers.
Estação de Londres da BBC.
The Latin American broadcast began with just 30 minutes a day, dedicated to news. Norman Zimmern was the service's first director.
We have at the moment only one transmission, so we have to sandwich broadcasts in Portuguese for Brazil with Spanish for the rest of Latin America. Naturally enough, we lose quite a bit of our audience every time we change from one language to another. But before long, we hope to have two transmissions going out at the same time, which will give us much more scope.
By July of 1939, new transmitters were ready, and airtime was increased to 3 hours a night, though the programmes were still dominated by the news of the day, like Britain's declaration of war on Germany in September of that year.
Desde las 11 de la mañana de hoy, el Imperio Británico está en guerra con Alemania. El señor Chamberlain ha declarado lo siguiente.
Soon the BBC was launching other language broadcasts in Nazi-occupied Europe. Meanwhile, audiences in Latin America were on the rise, partly thanks to rebroadcasting agreements with local stations in each country. Alberto Palaus was a former head of the Latin American service. Here he is speaking in 1998.
La guerra fue lo que nos consiguió.
The war opened up a huge auditorium for us in Latin America because people came to realize that news from the BBC was trustworthy. At that time, there was a lot of resources available. So apart from the informative part, we had lots of cultural programs, radio theater, art, science, trades, industry. So we soon established our brief to inform, educate and entertain a little.
One of the highlights of the BBC's wartime broadcast to Brazil were the dispatches from war correspondent Francis Hallowell. Hallowell was sent to Italy with Brazilian troops fighting there alongside the Allies. Here he is reporting from a frontline post in an army kitchen. Getting those recordings back to London was a feat in itself. They were first sent to American forces in Florence and then on to Rome, from where they were transmitted back to England. A team of producers would also work into the small hours translating the BBC's English news programmes for rebroadcast in Portuguese and Spanish.
Radio Gazeta.
But even far from the front line, broadcasting under the German air raids in London could be dangerous. Jorge Camacho, a Colombian, was one of the first presenters in Spanish and became the programme organiser.
Recuerdo el primer programa teatral dramático basado en las campañas.
I remember the first radio drama we put on, based on the campaign of Simón Bolívar, in which I played the main part. And I remember the air raids at the end of 1940, which destroyed my office, although I was lucky not to be inside at the time.
When a bomb exploded outside Broadcasting House in 1940, more than 1,000 London-based staff of the whole overseas service, as the World Service was then known, had to be relocated. The Latin Americans were rehoused in a grand location in leafy Hertfordshire, though some production still went on in central London, albeit underground.
Señoras y señores, presentamos
Carrusel Londinense.
Había un programa de variedades que se llamaba Carrusel Londinense.
There was a program called London Carousel, for which we used to get together each week in the Paris cinema, the only underground cinema in London. The BBC had hired it because it provided protection from the air raids. So the Latin American service and members of the Latin American community in London used to meet there each week to watch a variety of programs with orchestras, music, singers and comedy. That lasted until the first years after the war.
Combining music and humour particular to Latin America, those broadcasts were able to reach into homes across South America in a way that British broadcasting had never been able to do before. By the end of the Second World War, the BBC's Spanish and Portuguese productions had been split into separate operations. There were more than 100 local stations rebroadcasting their programmes on medium wave across Central and South America. And professional actors were at last available in London to supplement the largely amateur cast of announcers, translators and secretaries. And it was in the immediate post-war years that the BBC's most ambitious productions were launched in Spanish. A 21-part series about Simón Bolívar and a 27-part production of Don Quixote.
Little fanfare there for the BBC's Mike Lanchon reporting on the wartime origins of the BBC's broadcasts of Latin America in Spanish and Portuguese. For the most part, those broadcasts are no more. BBC Mundo, which does news in Spanish, is now online only. I'm Marco Werman. Human rights advocates in Rio de Janeiro were stunned by the murder of one of their own. Now they want answers from investigators.
Because killing a human rights defender is not only trying to kill one person. It's trying to kill a movement, it's trying to kill an idea, it's trying to kill a struggle.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Last week, Brazil lost one of its most outspoken politicians, Marielle Franco, the beloved Rio de Janeiro city councillor and rights activist. Last Wednesday night, Franco's car was sprayed with bullets. She and her driver were both killed. Franco was on her way out of an event that night called Young Black Women Who Are Changing Power Structures. Mourners and demonstrators filled the streets of Rio the next day and the next day, calling for justice and to carry on her causes, and protests continued through the weekend. Renata Neder is a research coordinator at Amnesty International Brazil. She joined us from Rio by Skype. Please forgive the quality of the line. So before Marielle was elected to the city council, she was on the Rio State Human Rights Commission, so I know your paths crossed. What did you work with her on?
Well, Marielle was a prominent human rights defender long before she was in the local council in the city of Rio. She was a partner of Amnesty International here. She was very active in defending the rights of Black women, the rights of LGBT women, and also the rights of Black youth from the favelas. And also she denounced strongly police killings and police abuses in general.
Right. So there were many causes that she had been involved in. What can you tell us about her work right before she was killed?
Well, a few weeks ago, Marielle was appointed as a rapporteur of a subcommission from the local council to monitor the impacts of the federal intervention and the use of the armed forces in the public security in the city of Rio.
Right. So explain that, because recently President Michel Temer sent the military, like the Brazilian military, into favelas in Rio to kind of quash violence, right?
Well, actually, the military and the armed forces have been used in different occasions for policing and for public security in Rio de Janeiro. And a number of violations have been committed in the past in Rio, including during the World Cup and the Olympics. Marielle was very vocal about denouncing these violations by the military. Very recently, there was a different development. On 16 February this year, the presidency declared federal intervention in the state of Rio de Janeiro on the public security area. This raised a number of concerns amongst human rights organizations, among experts on public security policies, and different bodies start to put together methodologies or initiatives to monitor the federal intervention. Particularly, a commission was established, and just a couple of weeks ago, Marielle had been elected and appointed as the rapporteur of this commission, which was a very important commission considering this context that we are living here.
Yeah, so understandably, a lot of people were very concerned about this military presence in residential neighborhoods in Rio. So Marielle Franco wasn't the only one who spoke out about this, but what made her different?
Well, Marielle was different because she was a human rights defender for many years. For over a decade, Marielle had been defending the rights of people in the favela, the rights of Black youth and the rights of Black women. And she had monitored before also the impact of, the use of the military on public security. Marielle was also a symbol. Marielle was a Black lesbian from favela in Rio de Janeiro. She was a reference of, how the residents from the favela can influence public policies, how they can, mobilize and have an impact. That's why it's also very crucial at this point that the state ensure a prompt, thorough investigation and give society an answer about who killed Marielle and why.
Renata, finally, you knew Marielle Franco. What was she like as a person?
Marielle was this beautiful, powerful woman, full of energy. She was an inspiration to all of us women and human rights defenders and activists and for the population of the favelas of Rio. She was always available to organize the meeting, an event, a public stunt. The loss of Marielle is a huge loss for the Rio de Janeiro community and society in general because she was taking us above and beyond. She was really leading people. And Marielle's voice will keep alive through all of us.
Renata Neder, a research coordinator at Amnesty International Brazil, thanks very much for speaking with us and telling us about the life and the death of Marielle Franco.
Thank you, Marco.
This next item is about a different sort of fighter who lost her life. I'm speaking of a British woman named Anna Campbell. She was 26 and was killed in battle in northern Syria last week. Campbell was fighting alongside the Kurds as part of a women's battalion. The World's Chris Wolf has been looking into her story.
Anna Campbell was a plumber. She lived in the country town of Lewes in southern England. But she was also a fierce activist for human rights, especially women's rights, according to her father, Dirk Campbell.
She was determined to live in a way that made a difference to the world. And she was determined to act on that and do whatever it took. She was prepared to put her life on the line, actually. There aren't many people who do that.
He says Anna was inspired by the experiment the Kurdish people are undertaking in northern Syria, and in particular their goal to create a secular, socialist state in the Middle East, Rojava, with equal rights for women. That includes encouraging women to join the military in all-female units, the YPJ.
The women participate in all spheres of the war, just like the men do.
That's UK-based Kurdish activist Dila Dirik.
The YPJ have their autonomous command structures. They take their own decisions autonomously. For the civilian women in the conflict zone who have been displaced, being rescued, being saved by women, this is very meaningful.
Anna Campbell told her father she wanted to help.
She came to see me in May last year, and she told me she was going to go to Rojava. She was quite adamant about it. I said, you could be killed. And she said, I know, Dad, there's nothing I can do to reassure you about that, but I've got to do this because it's the most important thing for me.
Fighting ISIS was a secondary benefit for Anna.
I am immensely proud of her and always will be, and was proud of her at the time. I respected her decision, although I knew that it could mean her death.
Anna Campbell is one of hundreds of foreigners who have gone to Syria to join the Kurds. Among them was this man, a former banker, who goes by the name of Maser Gifford, who spoke to the BBC this morning.
I knew her very well. I came in with her in May. Anna was full of life, full of enthusiasm. She was so desperate to join the YPJ. She had heard all about them, the resistance against the Islamic State, the things that they were doing for the communities that they were liberating. So she was absolutely inspired.
Anna is the eighth Briton to be killed fighting for the Kurds, but she did not die fighting ISIS. Her Kurdish comrades say she died fighting the Turks in northwest Syria. Things have changed in Syria in the last few months with the near defeat of the Islamic State. Since late last year, NATO ally Turkey has been fighting the Kurds in Syria, the YPG. The Turks see them as an offshoot of the Kurdish rebel group inside Turkey, the PKK. Here's Kurdish MP Amat Berat Chonka.
They have the same organizational structure. They have the same leadership. The United States understand that PKK is a terrorist organization and it has connections to YPG, and they are coming to a realization that they are making a big mistake by supporting this group.
It's even more complicated than that. The US and the UK do indeed list the PKK as terrorists. That's the rebels in Turkey. But the YPG in Syria are allies of the US in the war against ISIS. However, the UK doesn't like any of its citizens going to fight in Syria, whether for or against ISIS. Just last month, it began prosecuting people returning from Syria who had been fighting for the YPG. That could have been Anna Campbell. But her father, Dirk, says that wouldn't have changed Anna's mind. She believed in the Kurdish cause.
She was a young woman, and there are a lot of young people in this country and around the world who are like her. Who feel that it's more important to live the life that you believe in, to live by your principles, to live by these very high principles that she had. And I'm full of respect for all of them. And we need to take more notice of them.
For The World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
One of the major pollutants pushing climate change is methane. Okay, I could go all schoolboy here and talk about flatulence. I won't. But when you're talking methane, you are talking emissions that come from sources like livestock and wetlands, and also from leaks from natural gas and oil wells. For our Livable Planet desk, Jason Margolis traveled to Colorado, where he met some engineers who are racing to find ways to detect and combat these methane leaks.
In their labs at the University of Colorado, research scientists Dirk Richter and Peter Webering were building lasers to detect gases when Richter heard about a contest being held by the Environmental Defense Fund.
My wife forwarded me a tweet from the EDF saying this is a challenge. We looked at it and say, well, I think I have an idea we can do this.
The EDF was looking for ways to detect leaks of invisible, odorless methane gas from things like oil and natural gas wells. The two engineers, originally from Germany and Sweden, were so confident in their idea that they formed a company to develop it.
We're a garage startup, classical garage startup.
Your garage or his garage?
His garage. Yeah.
How could you flip a coin or a garage?
He has more basement.
The device they developed in Richter's basement is the size of a moving box with a laser and some mirrors. It runs on solar power. The lasers detect methane by the way its molecules absorb light.
We can tune the color or the wavelength very, very precise. So the more molecules you have along the laser line, the more each molecule will eat a little bit of your light.
Imagine a laser being a Pac-Man of a specific color. The more it eats of a certain color, it grows fatter and fatter and fatter.
The fatter the light, the more methane is present. At high levels, the box pings the oil or gas company.
They can get an email, notification, alarms.
Webering says that's a lot cheaper than how leaks are found now.
Right now, how do we know if there is leaks? People have to manually go around and check and come back at the site from time to time, and that takes them a lot of work, right? A waste of money.
And that's been the big problem. Finding methane leaks has been really expensive, but the cost of not finding them might be even higher. Methane is the main component of natural gas. It produces CO2 when it's burned. That's a big climate pollutant. But the methane itself is the far bigger concern when it escapes from gas and oil wells.
It traps 84 times more heat than carbon dioxide in the short term. That's why we realized that the world needs a smoke alarm for methane.
Aileen Nowlin is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
What's important is that ending oil and gas methane emissions is one of the most cost-effective and impactful climate solutions anywhere. Just using the solutions that are no net cost would have the same impact as closing all of China's coal power plants.
That's why the EDF held its contest. The grand prize for the best methane detectors? $0. Instead, Nowlin says the two winners got connections to oil and gas companies.
This relationship is actually very rare and harder to get than money.
Shell and the Norwegian company Statoil are both now trying out Richter and Weberring's prototypes. Desikin Sundarajan with Statoil spoke to me from Norway. He says in some cases, just knowing there's a leak, that's the hard part. Once a leak is detected,
they are very easy to fix. That's a matter of a wrench and a few hours.
Other leaks are harder to fix, but good, cheap detectors can at least help spot them. And preventing those leaks isn't just about protecting the environment. Escaping methane means escaping profits. Sundarajan says that's one reason his company got involved in the effort to develop cheaper detectors.
The initial implementations of any technology are very expensive, but then we need pioneers like Statoil and other companies to come forward and do more and more of these technology pilots where the cost of the technology then can be driven down.
Engineers Richter and Weberring have come a long way down that road already. In the 4 years they've been working on the project, they've transformed equipment costing hundreds of thousands of dollars into portable devices that cost a few thousand.
So that was the challenge, how to make it much, much cheaper and still good enough.
The technology today is there to solve the leak problem. It is now to the oil and gas industry as a whole to adapt it, to embrace it.
Other engineers and startups are also looking to tackle the methane problem with things like drones to measure emissions over bigger areas than just a single well. Their solutions might still seem pricey, but when you factor in the long-term costs of climate change, these small contraptions could start to look like a lot more of a bargain. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boulder, Colorado.
You know, given how important teachers are, you'd think there'd be more talk about the Global Teacher Prize than the Oscars. Although that is a good way to think about the Global Teacher Prize, the Oscars for educators across the globe. It was awarded this weekend. The prize comes from a foundation established by a Dubai-based businessman. And this year there were some 30,000 entries from more than 170 countries. 10 finalists gathered in Dubai for the announcement this past weekend. The Daily Show's Trevor Noah was host.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrea Zafiraku.
Andrea Zafiraku teaches art and textiles in one of the poorest communities in North London. In accepting her award, she focused not on herself or her work, but on her students.
They have tough lives. They live in crowded homes, and sometimes it's a challenge for them to find peace and a quiet place to study. Others are unable to stay for after-school activities because they are carers or have to look after their younger brothers and sisters whilst their parents go to work.
Zafiraku is one of those teachers who's gone the extra mile, extra miles. She taught herself greetings in some of the dozens of different languages spoken at the school. And when she found out that many students don't have space at home to do homework, she created a place at school for extra lessons.
Whatever issues they are having at home, whatever is missing from their life or causing them pain, our school is theirs.
After the announcement, some of Zafiraku's students spoke about her win.
I wasn't even shocked because from the start I've been supporting Miss Zafiraku and I knew she was going to win the award.
I feel really lucky and fortunate to be taught by the world's best teacher.
I had faith in her that she would win and she won, so that's good.
It's really amazing to be taught by a teacher who's taught textile to me and that now she's won the Global Teacher Prize. She can do anything now to make us really proud.
As for Zafiraku's prize, it is $1 million. That will come to her in equal payments over the next decade. Under one condition, Zafiraku has to remain a classroom teacher for the next 5 years. Finally today, there have been some crazy upsets in the men's NCAA basketball tournament this year, but none crazier than this.
Every game that we saw was close. This has been just total destruction.
Look at this.
Yeah, total destruction. That was the call as the University of Maryland Baltimore County beat the University of Virginia in a stunning upset. UMBC, a 16 seed. UVA, not just a number one seed, but the top seed in the entire tournament. A 16 seed beating a number one seed, that is the first time it's ever happened in the men's tournament. And if there's one UMBC player we need to talk about, it's KJ Maura, the 5'8" on a good day point guard, was one of the smallest players on the court. His Terriers were on fire, but he looked like he was playing for a higher power. Robert Cañada used to coach KJ Maura when the player was 8 years old up until he turned 14 through the Fricomar Basketball Club in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Now Robert is the director of Puerto Rico Elite Basketball. Robert, how did you watch the game? Was it a kind of group watch thing?
Yeah, well, I watched it with my family. And we were excited and we were crazy at the beginning. Like the game was tied at the half. We were like jumping and all over, all my friends and all the coach down here. We were like on a chat talking about the game and talking about KJ and talking about how great they're doing. And finally, they did it.
Yeah. So what was that like? Did you hear, was all of San Juan like cheering?
Yeah. Yeah. It was everybody was watching that game. Everybody.
What did it feel like for you, his former coach, to watch him play and to see this victory against Virginia?
Oh, it was an honor to me just to see him there, just to see how far he went. Just to get that to that stage, it was, there's no words to describe that.
I know you've been in touch with KJ's family. They came to the mainland from Puerto Rico just to watch him play. What have they told you about how all this has felt to them?
Yeah, I spoke to his father 2 days ago. He told me that he thanks all the Puerto Ricans' support that he has on these days. And they went against all odds and they did it. They get where they wants to be.
I know the family home in Puerto Rico got pretty badly damaged in Hurricane Maria. It can't have been an easy season for KJ with that on his mind. What kind of qualities does this kid have that let him focus and make his territory proud?
He has a lot of heart. He started putting on Facebook and on all the social medias talking about Puerto Rico, like what he can do to help, because he was far away. He was in Baltimore. And he was always taking care to his family. And I know it was tough because it was tough to everybody down here, but he has a big heart. He has a really, really big heart. He's a great, great kid.
In this moment, Puerto Rico really still suffering. What does KJ Maura's success mean for the island?
He gives us hope because we saw what he did, and that will give us forces to get stronger down here. We still without power. Some part of the island doesn't have power.
Right.
But we're going to take this like a little light of hope so we can get over and be like always we have been, like a great island with a lot of heart and real, real brave.
Robert, what's your favorite KJ Maura story?
My favorite KJ? All right. That's funny. We were in a tournament down here in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
We were losing by 5, like with, I think it was 9 seconds to go. And he told me, Robert, don't worry, we're going to win this game. And we did it.
He just
steal the ball, make a 3, another steal, another 3, game over.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah, that was the day that I started believing him. I was like, if he did this, he can do whatever he wants.
So, I mean, like if some kid who was like 5'6" came to you now and said, show me what to do. Would you have different feelings because of what you were able to see through with KJ?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because what he did was great. Also, down here, we are short. Like you see, the only NBA player that we have is JJ Barea. And he's also short. I think he's 5'11". So when I see them, I just told him, just keep playing, keep doing what you do, and believe in yourself. Just watch KJ, just watch JJ Barea.
Yeah, you're only short on the measuring stick, right?
Exactly.
Thanks so much for being with us, Robert.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You can totally hear the pride there. That was Robert Cañada, KJ Maura's youth coach in Puerto Rico. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.